Chapter 2. The Bringer of Light. Introduction. The picture of the human condition that emerges from the Nikayas, as sketched in the preceding chapter, is the background against which the manifestation of the Buddha in the world acquires a heightened and deepened significance. Unless we view the Buddha against this multidimensional background, extending from the most personal and individual exigencies of the present to the vast impersonal rhythms of cosmic time, any interpretation we may arrive at about his role is bound to be incomplete. Far from capturing the viewpoint of the compilers of the Nikayas, our interpretation will be influenced as much by our own presuppositions as by theirs, perhaps even more so. Depending on our biases and predispositions, we may choose to regard the Buddha as a liberal ethical reformer of a degenerate Brahmanism, as a great secular humanist, as a radical empiricist, as an existential psychologist, as the proponent of a sweeping agnosticism, or as the precursor of any other intellectual fashion that meets our fancy. The Buddha who stares back at us from the texts will be too much a reflection of ourselves, too little an image of the enlightened one. Perhaps in interpreting a body of ancient religious literature, we can never fully avoid inserting ourselves and our own values into the subject we are interpreting. However, though we may never achieve perfect transparency, we can limit the impact of personal bias upon the process of interpretation by giving the words of the texts due respect. When we pay this act of homage to the Nikayas, when we take seriously their own account of the background to the Buddha's manifestation in the world, we will see that they ascribe to his mission nothing short of a cosmic scope. Against the background of a universe with no conceivable bounds in time, a universe within which living beings, enveloped in the darkness of ignorance, wander along bound to the suffering of old age, sickness, and death, the Buddha arrives as the torchbearer of humankind. Ukadharo, Manusanam, bringing the light of wisdom. In the other words of text 2.1, his arising in the world is the manifestation of great vision, of great light, of great radiance. Having discovered for himself the perfect peace of liberation, he kindles for us the light of knowledge, which reveals both the truths that we must see for ourselves and the path of practice that culminates in this liberating vision. According to Buddhist tradition, the Buddha Gautama is not merely one unique individual who puts in an unprecedented appearance on the stage of human history and then bows out forever. He is, rather, the fulfillment of a primordial archetype, the most recent member of a cosmic dynasty of Buddhas, constituted by numberless perfectly enlightened ones of the past and sustained by perfectly enlightened ones continuing indefinitely onward into the future. Early Buddhism, even in the archaic root texts of the Nikayas, already recognizes a plurality of Buddhas who all conform to certain fixed patterns of behavior, the broader outlines of which are described in the opening sections of the Mahapadana Sutta, Digha Nikaya, 14, not represented in the present anthology. The word Tathagata, which the texts use as an epithet for a Buddha, points to this fulfillment of a primordial archetype. The word means both the one who has come thus, Tatha Agata, that is, who has come into our midst in the same way that the Buddhas of the past have come, and the one who has gone thus, Tatha Gata, that is, who has gone to the ultimate peace, Nibbana, in the same way that the Buddhas of the past have gone. Though the Nikayas stipulate that in any given world system, at any given time, only one perfectly enlightened Buddha can arise, the arising of Buddhas is intrinsic to the cosmic process, like a meteor against the blackness of the night sky. From time to time, a Buddha will appear against the backdrop of boundless space and time, lighting up the spiritual firmament of the world, shedding the brilliance of his wisdom upon those capable of seeing the truths that he illuminates. The being who is to become a Buddha is called, in Pali, a bodhisatta, a word better known in the Sanskrit form, bodhisattva, According to common Buddhist tradition, a bodhisattva is one who undertakes a long course of spiritual development, consciously motivated by the aspiration to attain future Buddhahood. Inspired and sustained by great compassion for living beings mired in the suffering of birth and death, a bodhisattva fulfills, over many eons of cosmic time, the difficult course needed to fully master the requisites for supreme enlightenment. When all these requisites are complete, he attains Buddhahood in order to establish the Dhamma in the world. A Buddha discovers the long-lost path to liberation, the ancient path traveled by the Buddhas of the past that culminates in the boundless freedom of Nibbana. Having found the path and traveled it to its end, he then teaches it in all its fullness to humanity so that many others can enter the way to final liberation. This, however, does not exhaust the function of a Buddha. A Buddha understands and teaches not only the path leading to the supreme state of ultimate liberation, the perfect bliss of Nibbana, but also the paths leading to the various types of wholesome mundane happiness to which human beings aspire. A Buddha proclaims both a path of mundane enhancement that enables sentient beings to plant wholesome roots productive of happiness, peace, and security in the worldly dimensions of their lives, and a path of world transcendence to guide sentient beings to Nibbana. His role is thus much wider than an exclusive focus on the transcendent aspects of his teaching might suggest. He is not merely a mentor of ascetics and contemplatives, not merely a teacher of meditation techniques and philosophical insights, but a guide to the Dhamma in its full range and depth, one who reveals, proclaims, and establishes all the principles integral to correct understanding and wholesome conduct, whether mundane or transcendental. Text 2.1 highlights this wide-ranging altruistic dimension of a Buddha's career when it praises the Buddha as the one person who arises in the world for the welfare of the multitude, for the happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the good, welfare, and happiness of devas and humans. The Nikayas offer two perspectives on the Buddha as a person, and to do justice to the texts, it is important to hold these two perspectives in balance without letting one cancel out the other. A correct view of the Buddha can only arise from the merging of these two perspectives. Just as the correct view of an object can arise only when the perspectives presented by our two eyes are merged in the brain into a single image. One perspective, the one highlighted most often in modernist presentations of Buddhism, shows the Buddha as a human being who, like other human beings, had to struggle with the common frailties of human nature to arrive at the state of an enlightened one. After his enlightenment at the age of 35, he walked among us for 45 years as a wise and compassionate human teacher, sharing his realization with others and ensuring that his teachings would remain in the world long after his death. This is the side of the Buddha's nature that figures most prominently in the Nikayas. Since it corresponds closely with contemporary agnostic attitudes towards the ideals of religious faith, it has an immediate appeal to those nurtured by modern modes of thought. The other aspect of the Buddha's person is likely to seem strange to us, but it looms large in Buddhist tradition and serves as the bedrock for popular Buddhist devotion. Though secondary in the Nikayas, it occasionally surfaces so conspicuously that it cannot be ignored. Despite the efforts of Buddhist modernists to downplay its significance or rationalize its intrusions, from this perspective, the Buddha is seen as one who had already made preparations for his supreme attainment over countless past lives and was destined from birth to fulfill the mission of a world teacher. Text 2.2 is an example of how the Buddha is viewed from this perspective. Here it is said, the future Buddha descends fully conscious from the Tusita heaven into his mother's womb. His conception and birth are accompanied by wonders. Deities worship the newborn infant, and as soon as he is born, he walks 7 steps and announces his future destiny. Obviously, for the compilers of such a sutta as this, The Buddha was already destined to attain Buddhahood, even prior to his conception. And thus, his struggle for enlightenment was a battle whose outcome was already predetermined. The final paragraph of the sutta, however, ironically harkens back to the realistic picture of the Buddha. What the Buddha himself considers to be truly wondrous are not the miracles accompanying his conception and birth, but his mindfulness and clear comprehension in the midst of feelings, thoughts, and perceptions. The three texts in section 3 are biographical accounts consistent with this naturalistic point of view. They offer us a portrait of the Buddha stark in its realism, bare in its naturalism, striking in its ability to convey deep psychological insights with minimal descriptive technique. In text 2, 3, 1, we read about his renunciation, his training under two famous meditation teachers, his disillusionment with their teachings, his solitary struggle, and his triumphant realization of the deathless. Text 2, 3, 2 fills in the gaps of the above narrative with a detailed account of the Bodhisattva's practice of self-mortification, strangely missing from the previous discourse. This text also gives us the classic description of the enlightenment experience as involving the attainment of the four jhanas, states of deep meditation, followed by the three vijas, or higher types of knowledge, the knowledge of the recollection of past lives, the knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of beings, and the knowledge of the destruction of the taints. While this text may convey the impression that the last knowledge broke upon the Buddha's mind as a sudden and spontaneous intuition, text 2, 3, 3 corrects this impression with an account of the Bodhisattva on the eve of his enlightenment, reflecting deeply upon the suffering of old age and death. He then methodically traces this suffering back to its conditions by a process that involves, at each step, careful attention, yoniso manasikara, leading to a breakthrough by wisdom, panyaya abhisamaya. This process of investigation culminates in the discovery of dependent origination, which thereby becomes the philosophical cornerstone of his teaching. It is important to emphasize that, as presented here and elsewhere in the Nikayas, see below, pages 353 through 359, dependent origination does not signify a joyous celebration of the interconnectedness of all things, but a precise articulation of the conditional pattern in dependence upon which suffering arises and ceases. In the same text, the Buddha declares that he discovered the path to enlightenment only when he found the way to bring dependent origination to an end. It was thus the realization of the cessation of dependent origination, and not merely the discovery of its origination aspect, that precipitated the Buddha's enlightenment. The simile of the ancient city, introduced later in the discourse, illustrates the point that the Buddha's enlightenment was not a unique event, but the rediscovery of the same ancient path that had been followed by the Buddhas of the past. Text 2, 4 resumes the narrative of text 2, 3, 1, which I had divided by splicing in the two alternative versions of the Bodhisattva's quest for the path to enlightenment. We now rejoin the Buddha immediately after his enlightenment as he ponders the weighty question whether to attempt to share his realization with the world. Just at this point, in the midst of a text that has so far appeared so convincingly naturalistic, a deity named Brahma Sahamapati descends from the heavens to plead with the Buddha to wander forth and teach the Dhamma for the benefit of those with little dust in their eyes. Should this scene be interpreted literally, or as a symbolic enactment of an internal drama taking place in the Buddha's mind? It is hard to give a definitive answer to this question. Perhaps the scene could be understood as occurring at both levels at once. In any event, Brahma's appearance at this point marks a shift from the realism that colors the earlier part of the sutta back toward the mythical symbolic mode. The transition again underscores the cosmic significance of the Buddha's enlightenment and his future mission as a teacher. Brahma's appeal eventually prevails, and the Buddha agrees to teach. He chooses as the first recipients of his teaching the five ascetics who had attended on him during his years of ascetic practices. The narrative culminates in a brief statement that the Buddha instructed them in such a way that they all attained the deathless Nibbana for themselves. However, it gives no indication of the specific teaching that the Buddha imparted to them when he first met them after his enlightenment. That teaching is the first discourse itself, known as the setting in motion of the wheel of the Dhamma. This sutta is included here as text 2.5. When the sutta opens, the Buddha announces to the five ascetics that he has discovered the middle way, which he identifies with the Noble Eightfold Path. In the light of the preceding biographical account, we can understand why the Buddha should begin his discourse in this way. The five ascetics had initially refused to acknowledge the Buddha's claim to enlightenment and spurned him as one who had betrayed the higher calling to revert to a life of luxury. Thus, he first had to assure them that, far from reverting to a life of self-indulgence, he had discovered a new approach to the timeless quest for enlightenment. This new approach, he told them, remains faithful to the renunciation of sensual pleasures, yet eschews tormenting the body as pointless and unproductive. He then explained to them the true path to liberation, the Noble Eightfold Path, which avoids the two extremes and thereby gives rise to the light of wisdom, and culminates in the destruction of all bondage, Nibbana. Once he has cleared up their misunderstanding, the Buddha then proclaims the truths he had realized on the night of his enlightenment. These are the four noble truths. Not only does he enunciate each truth and briefly define its meaning, but he describes each truth from three perspectives. These constitute the three turnings of the wheel of the Dhamma, referred to later in the discourse. With respect to each truth, the first turning is the wisdom that illuminates the particular nature of that noble truth. The second turning is the understanding that each noble truth imposes a particular task to be accomplished. Thus, the first noble truth, the truth of suffering, is to be fully understood. The second truth, the truth of suffering's origin or craving, is to be abandoned. The third truth, the truth of cessation of suffering, is to be realized. And the fourth truth, the truth of the path, is to be developed. The third turning is the understanding that the four functions regarding the four noble truths have been completed. The truth of suffering has been fully understood. Craving has been abandoned. The cessation of suffering has been realized. And the path has been fully developed. It was only when he understood the four noble truths in these three turnings and 12 modes, he says, that he could claim that he had attained unsurpassed perfect enlightenment. The Dhammakakkappavattana Sutta illustrates once again the blending of the two stylistic modes I referred to earlier. The discourse proceeds almost entirely in the realistic naturalistic mode until we approach the end, when the Buddha completes his sermon. The cosmic significance of the event is illuminated by a passage showing how the deities in each successive celestial realm applaud the discourse and shout the good news up to the deities in the next higher realm. At the same time, the entire world system quakes and shakes, and a great light, surpassing the radiance of the gods, appears in the world. Then, at the very end, we return from this glorious scene back to the prosaic human realm, to behold the Buddha briefly congratulating the ascetic Kondanya for gaining the dust-free, stainless vision of the Dhamma. In one split second, the lamp of the doctrine has passed from master to disciple, to begin its journey throughout India and across the world. Chapter 2. The Bringer of Light. Part 1. One Person. Monks, there is one person who arises in the world for the welfare of the multitude, for the happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the good, welfare, and happiness of devas and humans. Who is that one person? It is the Tathagata, the Arahant, the perfectly enlightened one. This is that one person. Monks, there is one person arising in the world who is unique, without a peer, without counterpart, incomparable, unequaled, matchless, unrivaled, the best of humans. Who is that one person? It is the Tathagata, the Arahant, the perfectly enlightened one. This is that one person. Monks, the manifestation of one person is the manifestation of great vision, of great light, of great radiance. It is the manifestation of the six things unsurpassed, the realization of the four analytical knowledges, the penetration of the various elements, of the diversity of elements. It is the realization of the fruit of knowledge and liberation, the realization of the fruits of stream entry, once returning, non-returning, and arahantship. Who is that one person? It is the Tathagata, the Arahant, the perfectly enlightened one. This is that one person. Anguttara Nikaya 1, 13, 1, 5, 6, 1, 22 through 23. Part 2. The Buddha's Conception and Birth. 1. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savathi in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. 2. Now a number of monks were sitting in the assembly hall, where they had met together on returning from their alms round, after their meal, when this discussion arose among them. It is wonderful, friends, it is marvelous, how mighty and powerful is the Tathagata. For he is able to know about the Buddhas of the past, who attained final Nibbana, cut the tangle of proliferation, broke the cycle, ended the round, and surmounted all suffering. That for those blessed ones their birth was thus, their names were thus, their clans were thus, their moral discipline was thus, their qualities of concentration were thus, their wisdom was thus, their meditative dwellings were thus, their liberation was thus. When this was said, the Venerable Ananda told the monks, "Friends, Tathagatas are wonderful and have wonderful qualities. Tathagatas are marvelous and have marvelous qualities." However, their discussion was interrupted, for the Blessed One rose from meditation when it was evening, went to the assembly hall, and sat down on a seat made ready. Then he addressed the monks thus, "Monks, for what discussion are you sitting together here now? And what was your discussion that was interrupted?" "Here, Venerable Sir, we were sitting in the assembly hall, where we had met together on returning from our alms round, after our meal, when this discussion arose among us. It is wonderful, friends. It is marvelous. Their liberation was thus." When this was said, "Venerable Sir," the Venerable Ananda said to us, "Friends, Tathagatas are wonderful and have wonderful qualities. Tathagatas are marvelous and have marvelous qualities." This was our discussion, Venerable Sir, that was interrupted when the Blessed One arrived. Then the Blessed One addressed the Venerable Ananda, "That being so, Ananda, explain more fully the Tathagata's wonderful and marvelous qualities." 3. "I heard and learned this, Venerable Sir, from the Blessed One's own lips. Mindful and clearly comprehending, Ananda, the Bodhisatta appeared in the Tusita heaven. That mindful and clearly comprehending the Bodhisatta appeared in the Tusita heaven, this I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 4. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Mindful and clearly comprehending the Bodhisatta remained in the Tusita heaven. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 5. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. For the whole of his lifespan, the Bodhisatta remained in the Tusita heaven. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 6. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Mindful and clearly comprehending, the Bodhisatta passed away from the Tusita heaven and descended into his mother's womb. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 7. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva passed away from the Tusita heaven and descended into his mother's womb, an immeasurable great radiance surpassing the divine majesty of the Devas appeared in the world with its Devas, Mara and Brahma, in this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, with its Devas and human beings. And even in those abysmal world intervals of vacancy, gloom, and utter darkness, where the moon and the sun, mighty and powerful as they are, cannot make their light prevail, there too an immeasurable great radiance surpassing the divine majesty of the Devas appeared. And the beings reborn there perceived each other by that light. So indeed, there are also other beings reborn here. And this 10,000-fold world system shook, quaked, and trembled. And again, an immeasurable great radiance, surpassing the divine majesty of the Devas, appeared in the world. This, too, I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 8. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, four young Devas came to guard him at the four quarters, so that no humans or non-humans or anyone at all could harm the Bodhisattva or his mother. This, too, I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 9. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, she became intrinsically virtuous, refraining from killing living beings, from taking what is not given, from sexual misconduct, from false speech, and from wines, liquors, and intoxicants, the basis of negligence. This, too, I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 14. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Other women give birth after carrying the child in the womb for 9 or 10 months, but not so the Bodhisattva's mother. The Bodhisattva's mother gave birth after carrying him in her womb for exactly 10 months. This, too, I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 15. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Other women give birth seated or lying down, but not so the Bodhisattva's mother. The Bodhisattva's mother gave birth to him standing up. This, too, I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 16. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, first Devas received him, then human beings. This, too, I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 17. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, he did not touch the earth. The four young Devas received him and set him before his mother, saying, "Rejoice, O Queen! A son of great power has been born to you." This, too, I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 18. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, he came forth unsullied, unsmeared by water, humors, blood, or any kind of impurity, clean and unsullied. Suppose there were a gem placed on fine cloth. Then the gem would not smear the cloth, or the cloth the gem. Why is that? Because of the purity of both. So too when the Bodhisattva came forth. He came forth clean and unsullied. This, too, I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 19. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, two jets of water appeared to pour from the sky, one cool and one warm, for bathing the Bodhisattva and his mother. This, too, I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 20. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. As soon as the Bodhisattva was born, he stood firmly with his feet on the ground. Then he took 7 steps facing north, and with a white parasol held over him, He surveyed each quarter and uttered the words of the leader of the herd. I am the highest in the world. I am the best in the world. I am the foremost in the world. This is my last birth. Now there is no renewed existence for me. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 21. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, an immeasurable great radiance, surpassing the divine majesty of the Devas, appeared in the world with its Devas, Mara and Brahma. In this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, with its Devas and human beings, and even in those abysmal world intervals of vacancy, gloom, and utter darkness, where the moon and the sun, mighty and powerful as they are, cannot make their light prevail. There, too, an immeasurable great radiance surpassing the divine majesty of the Devas appeared in the world, and the beings reborn there perceived each other by that light. So, indeed, there are also other beings reborn here. And this 10,000-fold world system shook, quaked, and trembled. And there, too, an immeasurable great radiance, surpassing the divine majesty of the Devas, appeared in the world. That when the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, an immeasurable great radiance, surpassing the divine majesty of the Devas, appeared in the world. This, too, I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. 22. That being so, Ananda, remember this too as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Tathagata. Hear, Ananda, for the Tathagata feelings are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Perceptions are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Thoughts are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Remember this too, Ananda, as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Tathagata. Venerable Sir, since for the Blessed One feelings are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear, perceptions are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Thoughts are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. That is what the Venerable Ananda said. The teacher approved. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Venerable Ananda's words. Majhima Nikaya, 123. Akcharya Abhuta Sutta. Abridged. 3. 118 through 120. 122 through 124. Part 3. The Quest for Enlightenment. Verse 1. Seeking the supreme state of sublime peace. 5. Monks, there are these two kinds of search, the noble search and the ignoble search. And what is the ignoble search? Here someone being himself subject to birth seeks what is also subject to birth. Being himself subject to aging, he seeks what is also subject to aging. Being himself subject to sickness, he seeks what is also subject to sickness. Being himself subject to death, he seeks what is also subject to death. Being himself subject to sorrow, he seeks what is also subject to sorrow. Being himself subject to defilement, he seeks what is also subject to defilement. 6 through 11. And what may be said to be subject to birth, aging, sickness, and death, to sorrow and defilement, wife and children, men and women, slaves, goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares, gold and silver. These acquisitions are subject to birth, aging, sickness, and death, to sorrow and defilement, and one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, and utterly absorbed in them, being himself subject to birth, to sorrow and defilement, seeks what is also subject to birth, to sorrow and defilement. 12. And what is the noble search? Here, someone being himself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeks the unborn supreme security from bondage, Nibbana, being himself subject to aging. Having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, he seeks the unaging supreme security from bondage, Nibbana, being himself subject to sickness. Having understood the danger in what is subject to sickness, he seeks the unailing supreme security from bondage, Nibbana, being himself subject to death. Having understood the danger in what is subject to death, he seeks the deathless supreme security from bondage, Nibbana, being himself subject to sorrow. Having understood the danger in what is subject to sorrow, he seeks the sorrowless supreme security from bondage, Nibbana, being himself subject to defilement. Having understood the danger in what is subject to defilement, he seeks the undefiled supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. This is the noble search. 13. Monks, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too, being myself subject to birth, sought what was also subject to birth. Being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I sought what was also subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement. Then I considered thus, why, being myself subject to birth, do I seek what is also subject to birth? Why, being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, do I seek what is also subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement? Suppose that, being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, I seek the unborn supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. Suppose that, being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I seek the unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, and undefiled supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. 14. Later, while still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessing of youth, in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the ochre robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. 15. Having gone forth, monks, in search of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Alara Kalama and said to him, Friend Kalama, I want to lead the spiritual life in this Dhamma and discipline. Alara Kalama replied, The Venerable One may stay here. This Dhamma is such that a wise man can soon enter upon and dwell in it, realizing for himself, through direct knowledge, his own teacher's doctrine. I soon quickly learned that Dhamma, as far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of his teaching went. I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed, I know and see, and there were others who did likewise. I considered, it is not through mere faith alone that Alara Kalama declares. By realizing it for myself with direct knowledge, I enter upon and dwell in this Dhamma. Certainly, Alara Kalama dwells knowing and seeing this Dhamma. Then I went to Alara Kalama and asked him, Friend Kalama, in what way do you declare that by realizing it for yourself with direct knowledge, you enter upon and dwell in this Dhamma? In reply, he declared the base of nothingness. I considered, not only Alara Kalama has faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Suppose I endeavor to realize the Dhamma that Alara Kalama declares he enters upon and dwells in by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge. I soon quickly entered upon and dwelled in that Dhamma by realizing it for myself with direct knowledge. Then I went to Alara Kalama and asked him, Friend Kalama, Is it in this way that you declare that you enter upon and dwell in this Dhamma by realizing it for yourself with direct knowledge? That is the way, friend. It is in this way, friend, that I also enter upon and dwell in this Dhamma by realizing it for myself with direct knowledge. It is a gain for us, friend. It is a great gain for us that we have such a venerable one for our fellow monk. So, the Dhamma that I declare I enter upon and dwell in by realizing it for myself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that you enter upon and dwell in by realizing it for yourself with direct knowledge. And the Dhamma that you enter upon and dwell in by realizing it for yourself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that I declare I enter upon and dwell in by realizing it for myself with direct knowledge. So you know the Dhamma that I know, and I know the Dhamma that you know. As I am, so are you. As you are, so am I. Come, friend, let us now lead this community together. Thus Alara Kalama, my teacher, placed me, his pupil, on an equal footing with himself, and awarded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me, this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to Nibbana, but only to rebirth in the base of nothingness, not being satisfied with that Dhamma. Disappointed with it, I left. 16. Still in search, monks, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Udaka Ramaputta and said to him, Friend, I want to lead the spiritual life in this Dhamma and discipline. Udaka Ramaputta replied, The Venerable One may stay here. This Dhamma is such that a wise man can soon enter upon and dwell in it, himself realizing through direct knowledge his own teacher's doctrine. I soon quickly learned that Dhamma. As far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of this teaching went, I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed I know and see, and there were others who did likewise. I considered, it was not through mere faith alone that Rama declared, by realizing it for myself with direct knowledge, I enter upon and dwell in this Dhamma. Certainly, Rama dwelled knowing and seeing this Dhamma. Then I went to Udaka Ramaputta and asked him, Friend, in what way did Rama declare that by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge, he entered upon and dwelled in this Dhamma? In reply, Udaka Ramaputta declared the base of neither perception nor non-perception. I considered, not only Rama had faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Suppose I endeavor to realize the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and dwelled in by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge. I soon quickly entered upon and dwelled in that Dhamma by realizing it for myself with direct knowledge. Then I went to Udaka Ramaputta and asked him, Friend, was it in this way that Rama declared that he entered upon and dwelled in this Dhamma by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge? That is the way, friend. It is in this way, friend, that I also enter upon and dwell in this Dhamma by realizing it for myself with direct knowledge. It is a gain for us, friend. It is a great gain for us that we have such a venerable one for our fellow monk. So the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and dwelled in by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that you enter upon and dwell in by realizing it for yourself with direct knowledge. And the Dhamma that you enter upon and dwell in by realizing it for yourself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and dwelled in by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge. So you know the Dhamma that Rama knew, and Rama knew the Dhamma that you know. As Rama was, so are you. As you are, so was Rama. Come, friend, now lead this community. Thus, Udaka Ramaputta, my fellow monk, placed me in the position of a teacher, and accorded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me, this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana, but only to rebirth in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Not being satisfied with that Dhamma, disappointed with it, I left. 17. Still in search, monks, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I wandered by stages through the Magadhan country until eventually I arrived at Uruvela, near Sinanigama. There, I saw an agreeable piece of ground, a delightful grove with a clear flowing river with pleasant smooth banks, and nearby a village for alms resort. I considered, this is an agreeable piece of ground. This is a delightful grove with a clear flowing river with pleasant smooth banks and a nearby village for alms resort. This will serve for the striving of a clansman intent on striving. And I sat down there thinking, this will serve for striving. 18. Then, monks, being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana, being myself subject to aging, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, seeking the unaging supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the unaging supreme security from bondage, nibbana, being myself subject to sickness, having understood the danger in what is subject to sickness, seeking the unailing supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the unailing supreme security from bondage, nibbana, being myself subject to death, having understood the danger in what is subject to death, seeking the deathless supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the deathless supreme security from bondage, nibbana, being myself subject to sorrow, having understood the danger in what is subject to sorrow, seeking the sorrowless supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the sorrowless supreme security from bondage, nibbana, being myself subject to defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to defilement, seeking the undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana. The knowledge and vision arose in me. My liberation is unshakable. This is my last birth. Now there is no more renewed existence. From Majjhima Nikaya 26, Ariya Pariyasana Sutta, 1, 160 through 167. Verse 2. The realization of the three true knowledges. 11. Sakaka asked the Blessed One, has there never arisen in Master Gotama a feeling so pleasant that it could invade his mind and remain? Has there never arisen in Master Gotama a feeling so painful that it could invade his mind and remain? 12. Why not Agivesana? Here, Agivesana, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I thought, household life is crowded and dusty. Life gone forth is wide open. It is not easy, while living in a home, to lead the holy life utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the ochre robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. 13 through 16. Later, while still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessing of youth, in the prime of life, as in text 2, 3, 1, 14 through 17. And I sat down there thinking, this will serve for striving. 17. Now these three similes occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were a wet, sappy piece of wood lying in water, and a man came with an upper fire stick, thinking, I shall light a fire, I shall produce heat. What do you think, Agivesana? Could the man light a fire and produce heat by taking the upper fire stick and rubbing it against the wet, sappy piece of wood lying in the water? No, Master Gautama. Why not? Because it is a wet, sappy piece of wood, and it is lying in water. Eventually, the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. So too, Agivesana, as to those ascetics and Brahmins who still do not live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures, and whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, thirst and fever for sensual pleasures has not been fully abandoned and suppressed internally. Even if those good ascetics and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment. And even if those good ascetics and Brahmins do not feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment. This was before the first simile that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. 18. Again, Agibesana. A second simile occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were a wet, sappy piece of wood lying on dry land far from water, and a man came with an upper fire stick, thinking, I shall light a fire. I shall produce heat. What do you think, Agivesana? Could the man light a fire and produce heat by taking the upper fire stick and rubbing it against the wet, sappy piece of wood lying on dry land far from water? No, Master Gautama. Why not? Because it is a wet, sappy piece of wood, even though it is lying on dry land far from water. Eventually, the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. So too, Agivesana, as to those ascetics and Brahmins who live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures, but whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, thirst, and fever for sensual pleasures has not been fully abandoned and suppressed internally. Even if those good ascetics and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment. And even if those good ascetics and Brahmins do not feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment. This was the second simile that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. 19. Again, Agivesana. A third simile occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were a dry, sapless piece of wood lying on dry land far from water, and a man came with an upper fire stick, thinking, I shall light a fire. I shall produce heat. What do you think, Agivesana? Could the man light a fire and produce heat by rubbing it against the dry, sapless piece of wood lying on dry land far from water? Yes, Master Gautama. Why so? Because it is a dry, sapless piece of wood, and it is lying on dry land far from water. So too, Agivesana, as to those ascetics and Brahmins who live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures, and whose sensual desire, affection, infatuation, thirst, and fever for sensual pleasures has been fully abandoned and suppressed internally. Even if those good ascetics and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are capable of knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment. And even if those good ascetics and Brahmins do not feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, they are capable of knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment. This was the third simile that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. These are the three similes that occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. 20. I thought, suppose with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrain and crush mind with mind. So with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained and crushed mind with mind. While I did so, sweat ran from my armpits, just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him and crush him, so too with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained and crushed mind with mind, and sweat ran from my armpits. But although tireless energy was aroused in me, an unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was overwrought and strained, because I was exhausted by the painful striving. But such painful feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. 21. I thought, suppose I practice the breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth and nose. While I did so, there was a loud sound of winds coming out from my ear holes, just as there is a loud sound when a smith's bellows are blown. So too, while I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my nose and ears, there was a loud sound of winds coming out from my ear holes. But although tireless energy was aroused in me, an unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was overwrought and strained, because I was exhausted by the painful striving. But such painful feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. 22. I thought, suppose I practice further the breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears. While I did so, violent winds cut through my head, just as if a strong man were pressing against my head with the tip of a sharp sword. So too, while I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears, violent winds cut through my head. But although tireless energy was aroused in me, an unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was overwrought and strained because I was exhausted by the painful striving. But such painful feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. 23. I thought, suppose I practice further the breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears. While I did so, there were violent pains in my head, just as if a strong man were tightening a tough leather strap around my head as a headband. So too, while I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears, there were violent pains in my head. But although tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and strained, because I was exhausted by the painful striving. But such painful feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. 25. I thought, suppose I practice further the breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears. While I did so, there was a violent burning in my body, just as if two strong men were to seize a weaker man by both arms and roast him over a pit of hot coals. So too, while I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears, there was a violent burning in my body. But although tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and strained, because I was exhausted by the painful striving. But such painful feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. 26. Now when deities saw me, some said, the ascetic Gotama is dead. Other deities said, the ascetic Gotama is not dead, he is dying. And other deities said, the ascetic Gotama is neither dead nor dying. He is an arahant, for such is the way arahants dwell. 27. I thought, suppose I practice entirely cutting off food. Then deities came to me and said, good sir, do not practice entirely cutting off food. If you do so, we shall infuse heavenly food into the pores of your skin, and this will sustain you. I considered, if I claim to be completely fasting while these deities infuse heavenly food into the pores of my skin, and this sustains me, then I shall be lying. So I dismissed these deities, saying, there is no need. 28. I thought, suppose I take very little food, a handful each time, whether of bean soup or lentil soup or veg soup or pea soup. So I took very little food, a handful each time, whether of bean soup or lentil soup or veg soup or pea soup. While I did so, my body reached a state of extreme emaciation, Because of eating so little, my limbs became like the jointed segments of vine stems or bamboo stems. Because of eating so little, my backside became like a camel's hoof. Because of eating so little, the projections on my spine stood forth like corded beads. Because of eating so little, my ribs jutted out as gaunt as the crazy rafters of an old roofless barn. Because of eating so little, the gleam of my eyes sank far down in their sockets, looking like the gleam of water that has sunk far down in a deep well. Because of eating so little, my scalp shriveled and withered as a green, bitter gourd shrivels and withers in the wind and sun. Because of eating so little, my belly skin adhered to my backbone. Thus, if I touched my belly skin, I encountered my backbone, and if I touched my backbone, I encountered my belly skin. Because of eating so little, if I defecated or urinated, I fell over on my face there. Because of eating so little, if I tried to ease my body by rubbing my limbs with my hands, the hair, rotted at its roots, fell from my body as I rubbed. 29. Now, when people saw me, some said, "The ascetic Gotama is black." Other people said, "The ascetic Gotama is not black, he is brown." Other people said, "The ascetic Gotama is neither black nor brown, he is golden-skinned." So much had the clear, bright color of my skin deteriorated through eating so little. 30. I thought, whatever ascetics or Brahmins in the past have experienced painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There is none beyond this. And whatever ascetics and Brahmins in the future will experience painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There is none beyond this. And whatever ascetics and Brahmins at present experience painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There is none beyond this. But by this racking practice of austerities, I have not attained any superhuman distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. Could there be another path to enlightenment? 31. I considered. I recall that when my father, the Sakyan, was occupied, while I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered and dwelled in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thought and examination, with rapture and happiness born of seclusion. Could this be the path to enlightenment? Then, following on that memory, came the realization, this is indeed the path to enlightenment. 32. I thought, why am I afraid of that happiness that has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome states? I thought, I am not afraid of that happiness that has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome states. 33. I considered, it is not easy to attain that happiness with a body so excessively emaciated. Suppose I ate some solid food, some boiled rice and porridge. And I ate some solid food, some boiled rice and porridge. Now, at that time, 5 monks were waiting upon me, thinking, if our ascetic Gotama achieves some higher state, he will inform us. But when I ate the boiled rice and porridge, the 5 monks were disgusted and left me, thinking, the ascetic Gotama now lives luxuriously. He has given up his striving and reverted to luxury. 34. Now when I had eaten solid food and regained my strength, then secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered and dwelled in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thought and examination, with rapture and happiness born of seclusion. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. 35. With the subsiding of thought and examination, I entered and dwelled in the second jhana, which has internal confidence and unification of mind, is without thought and examination, and has rapture and happiness born of concentration. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. 36. With the fading away as well of rapture, I dwelled equanimous and mindful and clearly comprehending. I experienced happiness with the body. I entered and dwelled in the third jhana, of which the noble ones declared, "He is equanimous, mindful, one who dwells happily." But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. 37. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous passing away of joy and displeasure, I entered and dwelled in the fourth jhana, which is neither painful nor pleasant, and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. 38. When my mind was thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to knowledge of the recollection of past lives. I recollected my manifold past lives, that is, one birth, two births, three births, four births, five births, 10 births, 20 births, 30 births, 40 births, 50 births, 100 births, 1,000 births, 100,000 births, many eons of world contraction, many eons of world expansion, many eons of world contraction and expansion. There I was so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance, such was my nutriment. Such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my lifespan, and passing away from there I was reborn elsewhere, and there too I was so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance, such was my nutriment, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my lifespan, and passing away from there I was reborn here. Thus, with their aspects and particulars, I recollected my manifold past lives. 39. This was the first true knowledge attained by me in the first watch of the night. Ignorance was banished, and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished, and light arose, as happens in one who dwells diligent, ardent, and resolute. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. 40. When my mind was thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of beings. With the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw beings passing away and being reborn, inferior and superior, beautiful and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. And I understood how beings fare on according to their actions thus. These beings who behaved wrongly by body, speech, and mind, who reviled the noble ones, held wrong view, and undertook actions based on wrong view, with the breakup of the body after death, have been reborn in a state of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. But these beings who behaved well by body, speech, and mind, who did not revile the noble ones, who held right view and undertook action based on right view, with the breakup of the body after death, have been reborn in a good destination, in a heavenly world. Thus, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw beings passing away and being reborn, inferior and superior, beautiful and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and I understood how beings fare on according to their actions. 41. This was the second true knowledge attained by me in the middle watch of the night. Ignorance was banished, and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished, and light arose, as happens in one who dwells diligent, ardent, and resolute. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. 42. When my mind was thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to knowledge of the destruction of the taints. I directly knew, as it actually is, This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. I directly knew it as it actually is. These are the taints. This is the origin of the taints. This is the cessation of the taints. This is the way leading to the cessation of the taints. 43. When I knew and saw thus, my mind was liberated from the taint of sensual desire, from the taint of existence, and from the taint of ignorance. When it was liberated, there came the knowledge, it is liberated. I directly knew, birth is destroyed, the spiritual life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming back to any state of being. 44. This was the third true knowledge attained by me in the last watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose. As happens in one who dwells diligent, ardent, and resolute. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. From Majjhima Nikaya, 36, Mahasaka Sutta, 1, 240 through 249. Verse 3, The Ancient City. Monks, before my enlightenment, while I was still a bodhisattva, not yet fully enlightened, it occurred to me, alas, this world has fallen into trouble, in that it is born, ages, and dies. It passes away and is reborn. Yet it does not understand the escape from this suffering, headed by aging and death. When now will an escape be discerned from this suffering, headed by aging and death? Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists does aging and death come to be? By what is aging and death conditioned? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is birth, aging and death comes to be. Aging and death has birth as its condition. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists does birth come to be? Existence, clinging, craving, feeling, contact, the six sense bases, name and form, by what is name and form conditioned? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is consciousness, name and form comes to be. Name and form has consciousness as its condition. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists does consciousness come to be? By what is consciousness conditioned? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is name and form, consciousness comes to be. Consciousness has name and form as its condition. Then, monks, it occurred to me, this consciousness turns back. It does not go further than name and form. It is to this extent that one may be born and age and die, pass away and be reborn. That is, when there is consciousness with name and form as its condition, and name and form with consciousness as its condition. With name and form as condition, the six sense bases. With the six sense bases as condition, contact. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. Origination. Origination. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what does not exist does aging and death not come to be? With the cessation of what does the cessation of aging and death come about? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is no birth, aging and death does not come to be. With the cessation of birth comes cessation of aging and death. It occurred to me, when what does not exist does birth not come to be? Existence, clinging, craving, feeling, contact, the six sense bases, name and form? With the cessation of what does the cessation of name and form come about? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is no consciousness, name and form does not come to be. With the cessation of consciousness comes cessation of name and form. It occurred to me, when what does not exist, does consciousness not come to be? With the cessation of what does the cessation of consciousness come about? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is no name and form, consciousness does not come to be. With the cessation of name and form comes cessation of consciousness. Then, monks, it occurred to me, I have discovered this path to enlightenment. That is, with the cessation of name and form comes cessation of consciousness. With the cessation of consciousness comes cessation of name and form. With the cessation of name and form, cessation of the six sense bases. With the cessation of the six sense bases, cessation of contact. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. Cessation, cessation. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. Suppose, monks, a man wandering through a forest would see an ancient path, an ancient road traveled upon by people in the past. He would follow it and would see an ancient city, an ancient capital that had been inhabited by people in the past, with parks, groves, ponds, and ramparts, a delightful place. Then the man would inform the king or a royal minister, "Sire, know that while wandering through the forest I saw an ancient path, an ancient road traveled upon by people in the past. I followed it and saw an ancient city, an ancient capital that had been inhabited by people in the past, with parks, groves, ponds, and ramparts, a delightful place. Renovate that city, sire." Then the king or royal minister would renovate the city, and some time later that city would become successful and prosperous, well populated, filled with people, attained to growth and expansion. So too, monks, I saw the ancient path, the ancient road traveled by the perfectly enlightened ones of the past. And what is that ancient path, that ancient road? It is just this noble eightfold path, that is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. I followed that path, and by doing so I have directly known aging and death, its origin, its cessation, and the way leading to its cessation. I have directly known birth, existence, clinging, craving, feeling, contact, the six sense bases, name and form, consciousness, volitional formations, their origin, their cessation, and the way leading to their cessation. Having directly known them, I have explained them to the monks, the nuns, the male lay followers, and the female lay followers. This spiritual life, monks, has become successful and prosperous, extended, popular, widespread, well proclaimed among devas and humans. Samyutta Nikaya 12:65 2:104-107. Part 4. The Decision to Teach. 19. I considered, this Dhamma that I have attained is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle, to be experienced by the wise. But this population delights in attachment, takes delight in attachment, rejoices in attachment. It is hard for such a population to see this truth, namely, specific conditionality, dependent origination. And it is hard to see this truth, namely, the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, Nibbana. If I were to teach the Dhamma, others would not understand me, and that would be wearying and troublesome for me. Thereupon, there came to me spontaneously these stanzas never heard before. Enough with teaching the Dhamma, that even I found hard to reach, for it will never be perceived by those who live in lust and hate. Those died in lust, wrapped in darkness, will never discern this abstruse Dhamma, which goes against the worldly stream, subtle, deep, and difficult to see. Considering thus, my mind inclined to inaction rather than to teaching the Dhamma. 20. Then, monks, the Brahma Sahampati knew with his mind the thought in my mind, and he considered, the world will be lost, the world will perish, since the mind of the Tathagata, the Arahant, the perfectly enlightened one, inclines to inaction rather than to teaching the Dhamma. Then, just as quickly as a strong man might extend his flexed arm, or flex his extended arm, the Brahma Sahampati vanished in the Brahma world and appeared before me. He arranged his upper robe on one shoulder, and extending his hands in reverential salutation toward me, said, Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma. Let the Sublime One teach the Dhamma. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who are perishing through not hearing the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand the Dhamma. The Brahma Sahampati spoke thus. And then he said further, In Magadha there have appeared till now impure teachings devised by those still stained. Open the doors to the deathless. Let them hear the Dhamma that the stainless one has found. Just as one who stands on a mountain peak can see below the people all around, so, O wise one, all-seeing sage, ascend the palace of the Dhamma. Let the sorrowless one survey this human breed, engulfed in sorrow, overcome by birth and old age. Arise, victorious hero, caravan leader, debtless one, and wander in the world. Let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand. 21. Then I listened to the Brahma's pleading, and out of compassion for beings I surveyed the world with the eye of a Buddha. Surveying the world with the eye of a Buddha, I saw beings with little dust in their eyes and with much dust in their eyes, with keen faculties and with dull faculties, with good qualities and with bad qualities, easy to teach and hard to teach, and some who dwelled seeing fear and blame in the other world. Just as in a pond of blue or red or white lotuses, some lotuses that are born and grow in the water thrive immersed in the water without rising out of it. And some other lotuses that are born and grow in the water rest on the water's surface. And some other lotuses that are born and grow in the water rise out of the water and stand clear, unwetted by it. So too, surveying the world with the eye of a Buddha, I saw beings with little dust in their eyes and with much dust in their eyes, with keen faculties and with dull faculties, with good qualities and with bad qualities, easy to teach and hard to teach, and some who dwelled seeing fear and blame in the other world. Then I replied to the Brahma Sahampati in stanzas, Open for them are the doors to the deathless. Let those with ears now show their faith. Thinking it would be troublesome, O Brahma, I did not speak the Dhamma subtle and sublime. Then the Brahma Sahampati thought, The Blessed One has consented to my request that he teach the Dhamma, and after paying homage to me, keeping me on the right, he thereupon departed at once. 22. I considered thus, To whom should I first teach the Dhamma? Who will understand this Dhamma quickly? It then occurred to me, Alara Kalama is wise, intelligent, and discerning. He has long had little dust in his eyes. Suppose I taught the Dhamma first to Alara Kalama. He will understand it quickly. Then deities approached me and said, Venerable Sir, Alara Kalama died 7 days ago, and the knowledge and vision arose in me. Alara Kalama died 7 days ago, I thought. Alara Kalama's loss is a great one. If he had heard this Dhamma, he would have understood it quickly. 23. I considered thus. To whom should I first teach the Dhamma? Who will understand this Dhamma quickly? It then occurred to me, Uddaka Ramaputta is wise, intelligent, and discerning. He has long had little dust in his eyes. Suppose I taught the Dhamma first to Uddaka Ramaputta. He will understand it quickly. Then, deities approached me and said, Venerable Sir, Uddaka Ramaputta died last night, and the knowledge and vision arose in me. Uddaka Ramaputta died last night, I thought. Uddaka Ramaputta's loss is a great one. If he had heard this Dhamma, he would have understood it quickly. 24. I considered thus. To whom should I first teach the Dhamma? Who will understand this Dhamma quickly? It then occurred to me. The monks of the group of five who attended upon me while I was engaged in my striving were very helpful. Suppose I taught the Dhamma first to them. Then I thought, where are the monks of the group of five now living? And with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw that they were living at Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana. 25. Then, monks, when I had stayed at Uruvela as long as I chose, I set out to wander by stages to Varanasi, between Gaya and the Bodhi. The Ajivaka Upaka saw me on the road and said, Friend, your faculties are clear. The color of your skin is pure and bright. Under whom have you gone forth, friend? Who is your teacher? Whose Dhamma do you profess? I replied to the Ajivaka Upaka in stanzas. I am one who has transcended all, a knower of all, unsullied among all things, renouncing all, by cravings ceasing freed, having known this all. For myself, to whom should I point as teacher? I have no teacher, and one like me exists nowhere in all the world, with all its devas, because I have no person for my counterpart. For I am the Arahant in the world. I am the teacher supreme. I alone am a perfectly enlightened one, whose fires are quenched and extinguished. I go now to the city of Kasi to set in motion the wheel of Dhamma. In a world that has become blind, I go to beat the drum of the deathless. By your claims, friend, you ought to be the universal victor. The victors are those like me, who have won the destruction of taints. I have vanquished all evil states. Therefore, Upaka, I am a victor. When this was said, the Ajivaka Upaka said, May it be so, friend. Shaking his head, he took a bypath and departed. 26. Then, monks, wandering by stages, I eventually came to Varanasi, to the deer park at Isipatana, and I approached the monks of the group of five. The monks saw me coming in the distance, and they agreed among themselves thus, Friends, here comes the ascetic Gotama who lives luxuriously, who gave up his striving and reverted to luxury. We should not pay homage to him, or rise up for him, or receive his bowl and outer robe. But a seat may be prepared for him. If he likes, he may sit down. However, as I approached, those monks found themselves unable to keep their pact. One came to meet me, and took my bowl and outer robe. Another prepared a seat, and another set out water for my feet. However, they addressed me by name and as friend. 27. Thereupon I told them, Monks, do not address the Tathagata by name and as friend. The Tathagata is an Arahant, a perfectly enlightened one. Listen, monks, the deathless has been attained. I shall instruct you. I shall teach you the Dhamma. Practicing as you are instructed, By realizing it for yourselves here and now through direct knowledge, you will soon enter and dwell in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. When this was said, the monks of the group of five answered me thus, Friend Gotama, by the conduct, the practice, and the performance of austerities that you undertook, you did not achieve any superhuman distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. Since you now live luxuriously, having given up your striving and reverted to luxury, how could you have achieved any superhuman distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones? When this was said, I told them, The Tathagata does not live luxuriously, nor has he given up his striving and reverted to luxury. The Tathagata is an arahant, a perfectly enlightened one. Listen, monks, the deathless has been attained from the home life into homelessness. A second time, the monks of the group of five said to me, Friend Gotama, how could you have achieved any superhuman distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones? A second time I told them, The Tathagata does not live luxuriously, from the home life into homelessness. A third time the monks of the group of five said to me, Friend Gotama, how could you have reached any superhuman distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones? 28. When this was said, I asked them, Monks, have you ever known me to speak like this before? No, venerable sir. Monks, the Tathagata is an arahant, a perfectly enlightened one. Listen, monks, the deathless has been attained. I shall instruct you. I shall teach you the Dhamma, practicing as you are instructed, by realizing it for yourselves here and now through direct knowledge. You will soon enter and dwell in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. 29. I was able to convince the monks of the group of five. Then I sometimes instructed two monks while the other three went for alms, and the six of us lived on what those three monks brought back from their alms round. Sometimes I instructed three monks while the other two went for alms, and the six of us lived on what those two monks brought back from their alms round. 30. Then the monks of the group of five, thus taught and instructed by me, being themselves subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking the unborn supreme security from bondage, Nibbana, attained the unborn supreme security from bondage, Nibbana, being themselves subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, seeking the unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, and undefiled supreme security from bondage, Nibbana, they attained the unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, and undefiled supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. The knowledge and vision arose in them. Our liberation is unshakable. This is our last birth. Now there is no more renewed existence. From Majjhima Nikaya, 26. Ariyaparyesana Sutta, 1. 167 through 173. Part 5. The First Discourse. Thus have I heard. On one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana. There the Blessed One addressed the monks of the group of five thus, Monks, these two extremes should not be followed by one who has gone forth into homelessness. What two? The pursuit of sensual happiness in sensual pleasures, which is low, vulgar, the way of worldlings, ignoble, unbeneficial, and the pursuit of self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, unbeneficial. Without veering toward either of these extremes, the Tathagata has awakened to the middle way, which gives rise to vision, which gives rise to knowledge, and leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to Nibbana. And what, monks, is that middle way awakened to by the Tathagata? It is this noble eightfold path, that is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. This, monks, is that middle way awakened to by the Tathagata, which gives rise to vision, which gives rise to knowledge, and leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to Nibbana. Now this, monks, is the noble truth of suffering. Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, illness is suffering, death is suffering. Union with what is displeasing is suffering. A separation from what is pleasing is suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. Now this, monks, is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. It is this craving that leads to renewed existence, accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight here and there, that is, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, craving for extermination. Now this, monks, is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving, the giving up and relinquishing of it, freedom from it, non-attachment. Now this, monks, is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. It is this noble eightfold path, that is, right view, right concentration. This is the noble truth of suffering. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This noble truth of suffering is to be fully understood. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This noble truth of suffering has been fully understood. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This noble truth of the origin of suffering is to be abandoned. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This noble truth of the origin of suffering has been abandoned. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This noble truth of the cessation of suffering is to be realized. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This noble truth of the cessation of suffering has been realized. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering is to be developed. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering has been developed. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. So long, monks, as my knowledge and vision of these four noble truths as they really are in their three phases and 12 aspects was not thoroughly purified in this way, I did not claim to have awakened to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment in this world with its devas, Mara, and Brahma. In this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, its devas and humans, But when my knowledge and vision of these four noble truths as they really are in their three phases and 12 aspects was thoroughly purified in this way, then I claimed to have awakened to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment in this world with its devas, Mara, and Brahma, in this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, its devas and humans. The knowledge and vision arose in me. Unshakable is the liberation of my mind. This is my last birth. Now there is no more renewed existence. This is what the Blessed One said. Elated, the monks of the group of five delighted in the Blessed One's statement. And while this discourse was being spoken, there arose in the Venerable Kondanya the dust-free, stainless vision of the Dhamma. Whatever is subject to origination is all subject to cessation. And when the wheel of the Dhamma had been set in motion by the Blessed One, the earth-dwelling devas raised a cry. At Varanasi, in the deer park at Isipatana, this unsurpassed wheel of the Dhamma has been set in motion by the Blessed One, which cannot be stopped by any ascetic or Brahmin or Deva, or Mara or Brahma, or by anyone in the world. Having heard the cry of the earth-dwelling devas, the devas of the realm of the four great kings raised a cry. At Varanasi, this unsurpassed wheel of the Dhamma has been set in motion by the Blessed One, which cannot be stopped by anyone in the world. Having heard the cry of the devas of the realm of the four great kings, the Tava Timsa devas, the Yama devas, the Tusita devas, the devas who delight in creating, the devas who wield power over others' creations, the devas of Brahma's company, raised a cry. At Varanasi, in the deer park at Isipatana, this unsurpassed wheel of the Dhamma has been set in motion by the Blessed One, which cannot be stopped by any ascetic or Brahmin or Deva, or Mara or Brahma, or by anyone in the world. Thus, at that moment, at that instant, at that second, the cry spread as far as the Brahma world, and this 10,000-fold world system shook, quaked, and trembled, and an immeasurable great radiance surpassing the divine majesty of the devas appeared in the world. Then the Blessed One uttered this inspired utterance. Kondanya has indeed understood. Kondanya has indeed understood. In this way, the Venerable Kondanya acquired the name Anya Kondanya. Kondanya who has understood. Samyutta Nikaya 56.11. Dhamma Kaka Pava Tana Sutta 5, 420 through 424.